Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, the 3rd of June, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry.
Yes.
Anything's possible.
Yes.
The sky's the limit.
Yes.
Shoot for the moon. Even if you miss, you'll land among the stars.
I love that statement. Yes.
We have a lot of cliches in our society about dreaming big. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the phrase be reasonable about what you want to accomplish doesn't go very well on a poster. Mm-hmm. But it might be a better strategy for getting things done and living a happy life. Because in a world where possibilities really are endless now, we have so many choices. Mm-hmm. We can do so many things. It might be better and more productive to constrain ourselves. And that is the thesis of a new book by journalist and author David Epstein. It's called Inside the Box, How Constraints Make Us Better. We're going to dive into that book later in the show. We're asking you this hour, do you feel overwhelmed by choices? How do you make decisions? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2 at whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
I think back to when I was a kid and the choice was hamburger helper.
What? Wait.
For dinner. What? The dinner choice was like chicken or hamburger helper. That
Those
was
were
it.
Your two choices?
Now you go on DoorDash. There's so many things.
To be fair, you were a child, so you had less choice because you were a child.
And we didn't do, you know, now that I'm older, we have all these choices.
Right.
We get confused. People get in fights. Like,
what did you pick, by the way, between those two?
Chicken.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have thought you would have gone hamburger.
I look
child.
Like a hamburger.
No, just because you're a kid. Usually kids are like chicken.
But my mom made some good chicken.
Oh, that's
true. But, you know, I think about now, you know, sometimes you get paralyzed. It could take you 45 minutes to decide what to eat for dinner just because you have so many choices.
We have a producer, and I'm not going to say her name.
Okay.
She's been spending months trying to pick Tupperware. Just Tupperware. Because there's so many choices.
Oh, my goodness. Before, there was just Tupperware.
Exactly.
That was it.
It was like Kleenex. It was, you got Tupperware, you got Tupperware.
Yeah. So we want to hear from you again, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2 at whyy.org. Do you feel overwhelmed by choices? How do you make decisions? Would love to hear from you.
And if you have Tupperware suggestions for our producer, again, just send them in as well. We're up like a Pyrex family. I'll just put that out there. Before we jump into our trio of local news stories, heads up, it's another Giveaway Wednesday, a new tradition here at Studio 2. Every Wednesday this summer, we're giving out two pairs of tickets to an upcoming event in the region. Stick around to the end of the show for the reveal of this week's Giveaway Wednesday event and your chance to win. It's a good one, folks.
Yeah, I would stick around for this one. Yeah, I would definitely stick around.
So. That's what we call a tease in the business. Go ahead, Cherry. Trio of local news stories.
Oh, yes. Starting with New Jersey primary election results, they are in. And starting at the top of the ticket, Senator Cory Booker, who ran uncontested on the Democratic ticket. He'll face Justin Murphy, who successfully won the GOP nomination with more than 33% of the Republican primary vote. Murphy is a Navy veteran. He was the underdog in that race. He had like no money in his campaign account, but he still bested his challengers. Booker, though, who is pretty popular in the Garden State, is favored to win in November, but we shall see. For the second congressional district, it looks like Cape May Mayor Zach Mulock will be the Democratic nominee. He earned more than 39% of the vote. Mm-hmm. He'll take on GOP incumbent Jeff Van Drew, a former Democrat who flipped to a Republican and is now a Trump ally. The other big race in our area was the 12th district, which centers around Princeton and Trenton, and had 13 Democrats vying for the nomination. Progressive Adam Hamowy, a veteran and surgeon, earned 29% of the Democratic vote. He beat his next closest opponent by 15 points.
Oh, wow.
So he is clearly the guy. He'll take on incumbent Republican Greg Mealy in November. And last but not least, I'll mention the 7th district Republican incumbent Tom Keene, who represents a section of North Central New Jersey. He, who had not been seen for months and had missed about 100 votes on the floor, he easily, you know, won. He was running unopposed. He'll face Democrat Rebecca Bennett this fall. Bennett is a former helicopter pilot. She earns 45% of the Democratic vote. And the Trump-backed Keene versus Bennett contest is expected to be a close one this fall.
Isn't Mikey Sherrill also a former helicopter pilot?
I know. It's a lot. I mean, yeah.
That's the pipeline of former helicopter pilots to politicians. It's big in New Jersey, apparently. From what I understand, not a lot of surprises here, honestly.
No.
And it's not like there's a big trend in that 7th district race against Tom Kaine. You know, you mentioned that the Bennett won, and she's more considered like the party pick, the moderate. In the 12th district, the progressive one. So different races shape out different ways. And I don't think there was an overarching theme from what I could tell, other than mostly the people that you would have predicted to win ended up winning just based on the contours of each of these races.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, you can check out all of WHYY's New Jersey primary election coverage at WHYY.org/elections.
Story number two now. Moving over to the Commonwealth, the Keystone State. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker's attempt to boost hotel and short-term rental taxes to fund homelessness prevention services looks like it's about to hit a dead end.
Oh.
And that's not because primarily of opposition from legislators on city council here in Philly. It's because of opposition from legislators in Harrisburg. Thanks to a little quirk in Pennsylvania law, Philadelphia cannot raise its hotel and short-term rental taxes without enabling legislation at the state level. Citing unnamed sources, the Inquirer says there is very little appetite to pass said legislation this session with the midterms coming up. So, in fact, the Inquirer reports that these taxes don't even have the votes they would need to pass in the democratically controlled state house, much less the GOP-controlled state senate. That's a big blow for Parker. However, her proposed $1 per ride tax on ride share is still in play because that particular tax, speaking again of the quirks of Pennsylvania law, does not actually need state approval, but still unclear if city council will support it.
Yeah, timing is everything with these types of taxes. And right now the timing is sticky because affordability is a top issue among voters. And the last thing a lot of these Harrisburg lawmakers want with re-election pending in November is to be tied to a tax. Governor Josh Shapiro would also have to weigh in on that. And he has a lot of prospects ahead. At the same time, though, I'm thinking it's still early. Deals always end up being made, so you never really know. And I'm sure Mayor Parker has a backup plan because she really is making dealing with homelessness a priority. So I wonder how she will pivot to pay for this, because she wants 1,000 more, you know, shelter beds. She wants all this recovery and prevention and all that. So I wonder how she's going to pay for it.
Yeah, one of her pitches when she was running is that she's a former state legislator and she has good relationships in Harrisburg.
Yeah.
And that just did not seem to bear out, or does not seem to be bearing out in this particular case. It doesn't mean she's wrong. It might mean that there's just too many headwinds right now. But, you know, people in Harrisburg do generally say positive things about her, even on the GOP side. It doesn't seem like, though, it's resulting in what she wants in this particular cycle.
Yeah. And we shall see. We'll be watching a third story.
Things we're watching.
Yeah. A Bethlehem police officer quit the force to join Love Island USA. That's a reality TV show. And the mayor of that town is big mad. Okay. The cop is 29-year-old Sean Rifle. He was sworn in as an officer with the Bethlehem Police Department in August of 2025.
That's pretty recently.
Yeah, but apparently his dreams are not to protect and serve. Oh, no. It is to find love in the high stakes and drama that is reality TV. Just 8 months after officially joining the force, he resigned so that he could appear on this Peacock reality show. Take a look at Officer Sean in the trailer.
I'm not a model, not an actor. I'm a police officer, actually. You could be having the worst day of your life, and I'll just help you sift through that. The more thoughtful you are, I think that is so pretty. I love it.
And with those muscles and that smile, I mean, he fits in on Love Island. But this made Bethlehem Mayor J. William Reynolds angry because of the time and investment the city made into Sean. Take a look, listen to what the mayor had to say to TMZ.
I don't have anything against, you know, this individual personally. It's just from our point of view, it's like I tell my kid at the park, like if you leave litter there, someone's got to pick it up. And for us who are struggling like every city across the country to attract, retain police officers, there is an opportunity cost when we invest money in somebody and then they decide to leave after 8 or 9 months.
And so now they got to start from scratch retaining people. But Avi, I did some back of the envelope math
here. Go
for it. Apparently on Love Island, Sean will get like a $500 a week stipend.
That's it?
That's it. And he was making like 70 grand to be a member of the police force. I don't know. Make it make sense. The math is a math into me, but I don't know.
You want it to make sense?
Yeah.
I think Officer Sean wanted to be on television and smooch attractive women, and he couldn't really do that as a mayor of the Bethlehem Police Force, or yeah, not as much.
As a police officer, yeah, yeah.
That opportunity was not available to him.
Yeah, so he wanted to smooch.
And be famous and be on television.
Yeah.
You asked for the explanation. I'm not saying it's my rationale. I'm saying that is the rationale.
And I'm just like, but this is, I can understand why the mayor is big mad, though, because it's just like.
I can't. No, I can't.
You can't?
Name one police department in eastern Pennsylvania that has an officer shortage right now that you name off the top of your head.
Yeah, well, most of them, right? Don't they?
What's the one you know for sure?
Bethlehem now.
There you go.
Yeah.
So he now has a big bullhorn to tell everyone that he needs more police officers. It's a national bullhorn. He's on TMZ. I think it's a win-win. If Officer Sean wants to be on Love Island, USA, which, by the way, is that a metaphorical island or a real island? Are they on an island?
They're on an island. There's some sand.
Okay.
I totally saw sand.
Either way, it works out for him. Also, now we all know that Bethlehem needs more police officers. So if you live in the Lehigh Valley and are interested, there you go.
You know what? That is actually a positive spin on this, because
I'm a positive guy.
Mayor Reynolds gets some free advertisement. We're talking about it. And
Sean gets to smooch.
Yeah, and I might even watch this season of
Love
Island.
We're smooching and we're winning here, folks. That's all we're doing.
It's a win-win. And we're going to be talking about decisions, because I wonder about that decision, but we'll be right back. This is Studio 2.
Smooching and winning, folks. That's what we're doing.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. There is a scene in the 1999 cult classic Office Space where the office gadfly is leaning on a cubicle describing an idea that he thinks is genius.
You see, it would be this mat that you would put on the floor and would have different conclusions written on it that you could jump to.
That is the worst idea I've ever heard in my life, Tom.
All right. Come on, Tom. We're going to give Tom a break today. We're going to give that idea a little bit of latitude. What if we did a little less hemming and hawing before committing to a decision? What if we gave ourselves a little bit more structure when thinking through the vast possibilities of life?
Yeah, a new book explores just that. In a world with seemingly infinite competition for our time and attention, how do we decide what to prioritize? Could more constraints and less freedom actually make us happier and more productive?
Joining us to talk about all of this is journalist David Epstein. He is the New York Times bestselling author of The Sports Gene, Range, and most recently, Inside the Box, How Constraints Make Us Better. David, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes. And for you, our listeners at home on the road or elsewhere, we would love to hear from you. Do you feel overwhelmed by choices? How do you make decisions? Do you give yourself a deadline? Do you have other limitations? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube streamers, you can put those ideas in the live chat.
David on YouTube, I got to read this one, says, I stood in the Lowe's paint aisle for an hour trying to choose a color. By the time I decided the store was closed,
oh my goodness,
and I was locked in, I was so embarrassed. Do you think that really happened? David
you
got
never
locked
know,
in the Lowe's?
Because that paint aisle is in the back. So.
That's not the David we're talking to today, by the way. Just want to clarify.
David
is one of our YouTube regulars. Maura on YouTube says, have you ever seen the Oreo section in a grocery store? It's too much. I'll simplify it for you, Maura. Get the double stuff. Anyways,
or
David
the lemon.
Epstein.
I love the lemon. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
David Epstein. So you argue in your book that constraints are helpful, that that there is a real benefit to constraints in time, constraints in resources. So I just want you to lay out your argument before we start getting into examples and picking it apart. What is the basic thesis of this book?
Is that in the abstract, we always say that we want more freedom, but in reality, useful constraints force us to clarify priorities and drive us into productive exploration that we would find in no other way. And in those two functions, with either clarifying our priorities or launching us in new directions, they can bring both more productivity and more satisfaction to our lives. And we can talk very directly about some of those things that those commenters were just mentioning, because that sort of decision challenges is one area where we see this show up more and more in a world that feels like it has infinite choice, where when choice sets get to a certain size, whether that's paint or Oreo cookies or whatever it is, people will tend to either not make a decision at all to make a worse decision, or even if they make a perfectly good decision, they will regret it. And we see this in more important areas than Oreo cookies, like people's retirement plans, where when the choice set is large, they're more likely to not pick anything at all. And in medical decisions, it's similar, to just back out of the decision when the choice set gets too large. And even if they do make a decision, and it's a good one, when the choice set is really big, people are more likely to regret it no matter what they chose.
Explain that last part, the regret part. Like, you make an objectively good choice by whatever criteria you're using. It is a good choice, and yet you are not personally satisfied. What's that about?
That's right. So our brains are comparison engines. And so the ability to compare the other things that you might have done can undermine the thing that you actually did. So let me give you a funny example from the research here. When it comes to entertainment, right? It seems like more choices should always be better for entertainment. And yet, since the introduction of infinite scrolling, people have been getting progressively more bored, according to international surveys by psychologists. And psychologists who are trying to figure out the mechanism of this would run experiments where, for example, they would assign people either to have a set of 20 videos and they could choose whatever they wanted to watch, or would just give them one video from that same set of 20 and they had to watch that one. And the people who are forced to watch the one are less bored than the people who have the 20 that includes that one. Mm. And so the theory is that just the idea that you could have made some other choice, that there might be something better out there, undermines the experience of the moment itself and the choice that you actually did make. So it's this comparison, and there's evidence that it's on the rise, you know, for obvious reasons, that it's just, you can kind of compare yourself to every person in the world at any moment you want.
And so I wonder, like, because you write that we overvalue limitless freedom and choice. And I want to talk about why we have been pushing for this idea that people can do anything. They can go anywhere. This is something that, as a people, we kind of wanted, and now we look at it and it's so overwhelming. So why do you think there was so much value placed on this idea of limitless freedom?
Well, because I think for most of human history, we had way too little freedom. And so this is very much a modern problem. So the idea of having too much choice or too many options about what to do with your life would have been laughable for most of human history. Mm-hmm. And it was really in kind of the late 19th century when you started to see when things like rulers and religions were structuring less of our life and consumer choices were exploding, when you start to see some of the most prominent philosophers and thinkers start to pick up this challenge, what Soren Kierkegaard called the dizziness of freedom, where all of a sudden you can kind of do anything. And it was leading to this rise in anxiety, because when you can do anything, it's not really clear what you should be doing or if you made the right choice. And so I think it's quite a modern phenomenon.
And one of the things you talked about was that the idea that people lose purpose in some ways, because before you knew what you were supposed to be doing. This was your choice. These were your options. And so you felt almost like a sense of purpose. How does choice sort of, having too much choice, too many options, sort of take that purpose away from you?
Yeah, I think there are a few ways. One of those is that we're able to individualize our lives in a way that turns out not to be that great for human thriving. We are a hyper-social species, not just a social species. We live in groups of thousands and millions. And that's how our brains have evolved to thrive in that kind of environment, where we have a lot of real in-person synchronous interaction. You can even see this like in studies where people are wearing headphones. They don't even know they're listening what music the other people are listening to. But those who are listening to the same music will be more collaborative in experiments, because there's something about this physical syncing that leads to human collaboration. And I think now, with all of our, you know, about a quarter century ago, the political scientist Robert Putnam wrote this famous book, Bowling Alone, where he talked about how things like television, which were making entertainment individual. So instead of people going to the community bowling club, they were doing entertainment on their own, started this process of like civic dissolution where mm-hmm. everyone would be living kind of in their own world. And I think we've sort of done that to ourselves. You know, the Soviet Union experimented with this in the 1920s with giving people individualized schedules for their work. And it was a social calamity because people weren't syncing up, right? They weren't, their obligations to one another were starting to dissolve. And so they had to do away with that. But I think in many ways, we're kind of doing it to ourselves in the interest of having a more convenient life. We're pulling up some of the anchors that actually add meaning.
We're asking you today, our listeners, do you feel overwhelmed by choice? How do you make decisions? Our number is 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. Diana on YouTube says, take a lesson from brilliant people like Steve Jobs, who always wore or wear the same thing every day. There is an anecdote in this book about a Nobel laureate, I believe, who wore the same thing every day. I think ate the same breakfast too. So nice comment there from Diana. Look a Bear on YouTube says the biggest choice I'm overwhelmed with every day is what's for dinner. Interesting email from Matt. Matt says marketers, especially in retail, know that you give people three choices: the least expensive stripped down model, the medium featured model, and a deluxe model. They know they will sell lots more of the medium model. People want something, but they don't want to look cheap or feel profligate. It's the illusion of choice. Okay, so that brings me to a question, David. If indeed marketers, companies know that we are overwhelmed by choice, it makes us unhappy, why wouldn't they then respond by paring down our choices and therefore making us happier, more content?
Yeah, well, usually, so that's a marketer talking about one specific company. So I remember like when I used to subscribe to The Economist and they would do this, they would give you three different subscription options. There was always a middle one. And even just looking at the value, it kind of only made sense to take the middle one. Right. So they were just setting these up as, it's called the decoy effect, right? They're just setting it up to drive you to a certain decision. But when you're in the Oreo aisle or the paint aisle, right, that's not just one company making that decision. It's a whole bunch of companies that are trying to get on those shelves, or more commonly, it's Amazon, right, where it's the everything store. And there's evidence actually in psychology studies that as consumer choices have exploded, so consumer choices have risen about 100 million fold since the Industrial Revolution, which 100 dwarfs
100 million. Wow.
100 million, which dwarfs the increase in wealth, which is only about 400 fold. And as they've gotten larger, people have come to start to view consumer decisions as extensions of their identity, even when they're buying household items. And so these choices get, you know, sort of freighted with a lot more weight. And I think it's hard for any single company to kind of combat that because they're all competing in this marketplace or on Amazon, right? Where it's sort of a tragedy of the commons. It's not up to any one company to do that.
But then you end up having value in a place like Wirecutter, which is a service that kind of just picks the three best of everything and tells you these are your best choices. So then you get these sort of like surplus sorters that then are able to make a business that way.
That is the exact value add of Wirecutter, whereas Amazon is the everything store. You know, Wirecutter is more like the only three things store. I bet a lot of people there buy like the middle option.
Yeah, because it's hard to make decisions. By the way, we'd love to hear from you today. Do you feel overwhelmed by choices? How do you make decisions? We'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTubers, you can leave your comments in the live chat. Let's bring in the caller. We have Steve from Reading on the line. Steve, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, a quick comment that there was an article some years ago called The Tyranny of Choice that kind of delves into this. And I wondered if there's any research about gender difference. I know with my wife and I make decisions quickly. I don't have regrets. She will go forever and want more and then be unhappy with what she – and a lot of my friends say the same.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve from Reading. And Avi and I actually talked about this yesterday because my husband tends to make decisions a lot faster than me. I think about things a lot longer. There's upsides and downsides to both things, but are there gender differences?
Yeah, I'm not aware of research that finds gender differences in this regard. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it must not be very prominent because I've read most of this research. There is one thing that could be related, though. So there are definitely individual differences in this spectrum of what's called satisficing to maximizing. So satisficing, it's a portmanteau of satisfy and suffice. And that involves basically setting sort of good enough rules and stopping when you meet that and moving on. Whereas maximizing is I'm going to evaluate every option. And, you know, even if I like what I'm watching now, I want to see what else is available. And it turns out that it's almost always bad to be a maximizer. Mm. Maximizers are less happy with their decisions. They're less happy with their lives. They're more prone to regret. They're more likely to prefer reversible decisions, even though that just prevents them from committing one way or the other. And there's evidence that some maximizing tendencies are on the rise, like socially prescribed perfectionism, where you're like endlessly comparing what you did to everyone else. And that did at least rise for young women faster than young men. Mm. So I've specifically been seeing some of that data with regard to younger people, and it's been rising in general, but some of the rise in this country has been faster among young women.
Yeah, so interesting. Before we go into examples, I wanted to sort of ask you about, so people, when we say the word constraint, I want you to sort of like, because we want to, you say having constraints in your life, having some limitations, some boundaries actually is a good thing, especially for decision making and productivity and creativity. So explain what that is and give us the reason why. So explain what a constraint specifically is.
Yeah, I would define a constraint as something that blocks the easiest path. So let's take, you know, whether that's a schedule that you have or a deadline or something, like things could be easier, right, or more convenient. The problem is convenience is not really good for us. So the cognitive scientist Daniel Willingham has written that you may think that your brain is made for thinking, but your brain's actually made for preventing you from having to think whenever possible, because thinking is energetically costly. And so left up to your own devices with no structure, you will go down what cognitive scientists call the path of least resistance, meaning you will just do the thing that comes most easily because you've done it before, because it's available, whatever it is. So for things like creativity, for example, that's a disaster. You don't want the path of least resistance. And so the best way to make someone more creative is actually to block whatever their first instinct is, whatever that first tool is that they reach for. And this turns out to be analogous to other areas of life where it's more convenient to sit at home and passively consume feeds or passive entertainment, but it adds much more meaning and value to your life if you have specific physical places you have to be at a specific day and time every week with specific people, but that's inconvenient. So constraints are things that are that block the most convenient solution. And obviously they can be bad, but I think the problem is in our desire always for more freedom that seems right in the abstract, we have actually overlook the fact that constraints can be these incredibly helpful tools.
Mm. Yeah. Let me read this comment from Aaliyah, who says, mm-hmm. As a practicing Muslim, I always start with what is Islamically permissible. That usually weeds out a lot. And then there are fewer options. Yeah. From there, I get to the end result I desire. Max says, I struggle with decisions, but I've adopted a mindset rule that helps break that block. If you're stuck between multiple choices, it's not because there is a correct answer that you just haven't figured out. It's because they all have pluses and minuses. You'll have regrets no matter your choice. So just pick one without more thought. Let's bring in a caller. This is Richard from Kimberton on the line. Richard, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment has to do with my experience as a longtime family physician. I've long counseled parents not to offer their children too many choices. It's fine to say, do you want vanilla or chocolate? But parents just in feeling that that's somehow enabling their child, they're really asking the children to make decisions that parents should make, this kind of abdication of a parental responsibility. And kids get overwhelmed with choices, and they end up being very spoiled and unhappy kids. That's my experience.
Hmm. Interesting perspective from Richard. So I wanted to go back to a couple of those comments, David, that I read earlier about like tools people use to kind of narrow down their choices, mm-hmm. and what the research suggests are the best tools or the best frameworks for narrowing down choice in a way that's personally satisfying. I know you've experimented and done some stuff in your own life to make yourself more productive with your writing. You can give some of those personal examples, but also if there are larger frameworks they fit into that could be applicable to other people.
Yeah, I mean, one of the commenters whose comment you were just reading was getting at something called Fredkin's paradox, where this is the idea that we end up spending the most time on the least important decisions.
Yes.
Because we're having trouble telling the options apart. And that either means that A, there's not much difference, and that's why we're having trouble telling them apart, or B, maybe there is, but we can't tell anyway. And so we end up agonizing over exactly the decisions where our agonizing doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
And so as Herbert Simon would have said, before we go into a decision, you want to set good enough criteria so that you're not just being blown by the winds of all the options that are there. I mean, so for me, I use, because I have maximizing tendencies, and so to, that's a polite way to put it. And so to kind of combat that, so if I, you know, it's like when I wrote Inside the Box, this book, I'm like, this has to be a 9 or 10 on the effort and quality mm-hmm. level. But I have a newsletter where, this isn't going to make anybody want to read it, but on Substack where I say, if a post gets to 6.5, I send it out. And good. That's my satisficing exercise. Mm. And it can be painful. There's always something else I want to add. But it's a really useful kind of exercise where when I hit that, I send it and I move on. You know, it's just like product designers who ship and then move on. And I use all kinds of constraints in, I mean, just a useful one. So I write a lot in the book about focus and attention and research on focus and attention, how it's co-opted unless we are structuring it ourselves. And one really simple thing that's really effective for people is something I call the Hemingway principle. So Ernest Hemingway would stop his writing days in the middle of a sentence because that said the next day when he wakes up, he knows exactly where to start.
Mm.
And what the research shows is that if you don't know where to start the next day, you'll fall prey to something called the mere urgency effect, which means you'll start doing stuff that seems urgent, even if it's not important. That could be checking feeds. That could be in your inbox. Email. So if you actually want to start with the important thing, the last act of every workday should be to specify exactly the thing. Like stop where you know what the next step is and specify that thing and start with that, because otherwise you'll start burning time and energy doing stuff that's low value but feels urgent.
Let me ask you about the writing process, though, because that's so interesting because you're a writer yourself, right? And you have to set constraints about how long the book's going to be and how long you want to spend working on it. And there are great examples. You have one from Isabel Allende in here about sort of like setting constraints that lead to creativity and productivity. But there, I was thinking of counterexamples, right? So the one I thought of was Robert Caro, who wrote this insanely long biography of a New York bureaucrat called Robert Moses. And you would have thought, boy, this guy needs some constraints. But it turns out to be one of the most groundbreaking pieces of nonfiction of its era, right? And so him being somewhat unbounded, it seemed like did lead to this incredible creative burst. And I'm curious, I just want you to wrestle with that. Like the idea of setting limits for a creative project like a book and when it's important to set those limits, but also maybe when it's important to like let those limits go a little bit because you could stumble onto something, a real opus, essentially.
Absolutely. It's a balance. And in research literature, this is called the explore-exploit trade-off. It's like, when do you, you know, take the bounds off and explore, and when do you start to focus yourself and say, now I have to use that knowledge I have to actually do something. What I would say about Caro is obviously an incredible writer, incredible reporter, also, you know, going to die before he finishes his biography of Lyndon Johnson because it's dragging on forever. And so I think that's been sort of a bit of a double-edged sword.
Same with George R.R. Martin in the Game of Thrones stuff, the fantasy series.
That's right. And so I think that both in the organizational behavior literature and in literature that looks at individual careers, what you want to be doing is toggling between some of that explore-exploit. So toggling between these periods where you sort of say, you know, I'm going to let myself explore more broadly here, but with an eye toward finding a time when you put some boundaries in and focus in. And that's exactly the way that I've modeled my own book writing process. So my book writing process is not Robert Caro, but it's long compared to most authors, where for the first year of Inside the Box, I didn't write a word. Mm. All I did was research and interview, read scientific papers. And at the end of the year, I had a 100,000 word note sheet. I printed it out, read it, and I let myself wander, you know, really widely during that time, printed it out, read it, and then forced myself to make a one-page structural outline from 100,000 words to one page. And if it's not on that, God. I have it right over it, actually.
Oh, God. We have to go to a break.
We're going to go to a break.
We're going
to
get back to that. That's David Epstein. That just made my one page. All right. It's David Epstein, journalist and author of this new book, Inside the Box, How Constraints Make Us Better. We're going to continue the conversation. We see your calls and your comments. We'll get to those as well. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, before we jump back into our conversation about decision-making, it's time to reveal today's Giveaway Wednesday artist. Al, hit it! Oh, yeah. It's not the connection with Marty Moscowen. It is her theme music. That's right. We have two pairs of tickets for an upcoming show to see 15-time Grammy Award-winning artist Bela Fleck. The concert is Thursday, June 25th at 6 p.m. as part of the Concerts Under the Stars series in King of Prussia.
Yes, and each pair of tickets to see the banjo player extraordinaire is a $100 value. So this is great, okay? Mm. And the first two people who email studio2 at whyy.org and ask for those tickets, they will get them for free. So make sure you email studio2 at whyy.org.
Right now. We're going to get back to our conversation with David Epstein, author of the new book, Inside the Box, How Constraints Make Us Better.
Yes, and we want to hear from you, our listeners, on the road or elsewhere. We'd love to hear, do you feel overwhelmed by choices? How do you make decisions? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2 at whyy.org. And for our Facebook or YouTube streamers, you can leave comments in the chat. Sherry says, this program today has me wondering how many hours we've spent making decisions, sorting through endless options, reading reviews, comparing choices, and second guessing ourselves. Raise a very good question, Sherry. Lauren from Philadelphia is on the line. Lauren, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. So I was listening to your program, and as a neurodivergent person, I was thinking about how just merely being neurodivergent causes me already to have a lot of constraint in my life. So there's a lot of things that aren't built for me. So I do have to, you know, my choices are already limited due to that. And I did think about a couple of examples. I have friends that are ADHD and autistic, and myself, I'm ADHD. So a lot of times food is a really hard one. Mm-hmm. Textures and certain, you know, things that we eat, we just can't really palate. So a lot of times, you know, we already have a very narrow limit of what we can eat anyway. So we're already limited in that choice. Some other things I was thinking of in regards to accessibility for people that are potentially disabled, clothing is a really big one. Yeah. Certain textures and, you know, like tags on clothing or certain materials, you know, people can't really stomach touching it, or it doesn't feel good on their skin. So I think being neurodivergent already has that sort of inherent limitation in our society that was not built for us.
Thank you. Thank you, Lauren, for those perspectives. You know, David, I think about this saying that I've always heard of making a dollar out of 15 cents. People who have constraints due to life circumstances, and yet they're still able to punch well above their weight. And so one of the stories that came up, and this is someone who was used to having things his way, was the Keith Jarrett story. And he was put into a situation where he was constrained and actually made magic because of it. Could you tell us that story and why this is sort of a really good example of that constraints can actually make magic in some instances?
Sure. So Keith Jarrett was a virtuoso jazz pianist and famously particular about everything in his performances. And when he was on this whirlwind world tour in 1975, one of his stops was in Cologne, Germany, where this teenage girl had sold out an opera house in Cologne to have one of his concerts. And so it's a huge deal for her. And Jarrett shows up hours before the concert, hits a few keys on the piano, and says, "Concert's off." Right? Mm. And she's freaking out.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the wrong piano had been delivered. So it was smaller than the one he ordered. The felt hammers were worn out. It had fewer keys than the piano that he had requested, which is pretty unusual. So he says, "No concert." And he starts leaving. And this young woman, her name is Vera Brandis, starts begging him, you know, "Please perform." And he, for whatever reason, he agrees to do it. But the piano, they try to get the piano in shape in a few hours. They get it a little better. But because the upper register is tinny and there are problems with the lower register, he has to sort of stay in the middle of the keyboard. The piano's not loud enough to get to the upper parts of the of the opera house. And so he pounds his foot against the pedal without pushing it down for this percussive element. And he does these sort of repetitive rhythms with his left hand to stay in the area that's usable, and then improvises with his right hand, improvises for about an hour, you know, massive standing ovation, leaves, doesn't think about it again. And this, the recording of this performance, it's an hour long, it can't be played on radio, starts playing in record stores as background music, and people start asking about it and asking about it and asking about it, and it starts selling and selling and selling. And it goes on to become the best-selling solo piano album of all time.
Wow. Mm.
And as Jarrett later said about this performance and another one, that when he would show up with these imperfect pianos that he never would have chosen, they would force him to explore creative territory that he never could have seen in any other way. And that's classically in line with this huge mountain of creativity research that one psychologist calls the Green Eggs and Ham effect. Mm-hmm. After the fact that Dr. Seuss wrote Green Eggs and Ham on a bet that he couldn't write a children's book using only 50 words. And that forced him to experiment with rhythm and develop this rollicking rhythm because he couldn't do the easy thing, right? Constraints force us off that path of least resistance, which can be difficult, but that's actually why it's a great creative prompt.
And that sort of that dollar out of 15 cents thing, like you have communities that have always had constraints, like I said, because and they come up with these creative workarounds. And so how do you know how much of a constraint is actually helpful versus crossing the line where it actually becomes harmful to decision making or harmful to creativity?
Yeah, it's
like,
interesting
where is
because
that
there,
line?
Are all these, yeah. There are all these sort of high-tech examples that are in the news now of where constraint has been useful in surprising ways. Like, you know, Ukraine got cut off from Chinese supplies and then had to create its own homegrown drone industry that now other countries are trying to copy. Or Anthropic, which is kind of surpassing OpenAI now, it's because their computing power was limited and so they were forced to, you know, develop in these other ways. But clearly constraint can go overboard and be bad. I mean, the word itself is practically synonymous with something that we find frustrating. And at least in the research literature, typically when someone is told not only what to do, but how to do it. Mm. So if they say, could I still surprise myself? And the answer is no, it's gone too far.
Mm. Interesting.
And I would also say the most common constraint that people are probably familiar with is a deadline, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the research on deadlines is kind of nuanced. Deadlines can either boost, you know, creativity and problem-solving ability, or they can squash it. And it basically depends on whether the deadline leads people to start multitasking and toggling between things, which is terrible for stress and productivity, or to monotask and focus maniacally on the most important thing to get done. And if they monotask, it really boosts their productivity, their creativity, all these things. But that often requires a boss or someone to protect them under that deadline. So it's not just always up to the individual.
So interesting.
We're asking you this hour, how do you make choices? Maybe any advice for choice making? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. Don says, in the 70s, there was a book called Future Shock by Alvin Toffler. We had to read it in 10th grade. It was about having too many choices and how it can paralyze our decision making. Needless to say, I think it's only gotten worse. Let's bring in a caller. This is Madison from Philadelphia on the line. Hey, Madison, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to circle back on the earlier point about gender roles. You know, I think it's really funny because my experience has just been the exact opposite. My boyfriend and I are the flip of what we were hearing from an earlier caller, where I am the quick, you know, hard decision maker, and he tends to make those decisions more so through like an emotional lens and kind of weigh every possible scenario in the how it's going to make him feel.
Interesting.
So I think it's just interesting that, you know, it's not always so black and white when it comes to gender. And a lot of it makes me wonder if for girls, is it how we're socialized and not socialized to make hard and fast decisions?
Yeah. Interesting call from Madison in Philly.
Yeah.
And David said there's not much he's aware of in the literature that suggests there really is much of a gender dynamic here. I wanted to ask actually about the art of interviewing because it's something we do and something you do as well, David. And I have come to believe that there is such a thing, I think, as over-preparing for an interview, because you open yourself up to the possibility of asking about too many different things. And sometimes if you just flip your notes over and you just follow the conversation, you will force yourself to ask questions you might have otherwise avoided, you might have felt uncomfortable asking, or that you might have missed opportunities to ask because you were too absorbed in your notes. I am curious how you think about constraints when it comes to asking questions of other people, something that you do a lot of in your job.
That's interesting you mentioned that, because I think I fell prey to exactly what you're talking about for a lot of my career. I mean, I was training to be a scientist before I became a writer, and I started, you know, and I write about science, and I would often, you know, read so many papers and get so in the weeds that I would basically have a script and would kind of follow it almost no matter what the other person was telling me, right? And I think as I've become a more mature interviewer, I still do quite a bit of preparing, but now that preparing is sort of subservient to being there in the moment and listening to the person, right? So I have it if I need to rely on it, but I want to be much more present and engaging with which way they're going, because I can't know some of the most interesting angles. So I completely agree with that. It's like, I don't go to the Larry King extreme of don't know anything about the person that you're interviewing, basically. But the way I try to do it is like to do a lot of prep, but then have that prep sort of like the rules of writing, right?
Yeah.
You want to know the rules and then sort of forget them a little bit.
Exactly.
Unless you really need to follow.
Well, look, interviewing is an art, not a science, but there was something to the Larry King would say, expand on that. And sometimes these celebrities, no one would ever say that to them. The person would go straight to the next, like, sort of scripted question, and he would say, expand on that. And all of a sudden you were in some uncharted territory with, Nicole Kidman or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it did work
totally.
On some level.
I mean, I think this is one of the things that sometimes makes Oprah such a great interviewer is, you know, I'm sure she has a plan about where she's trying to go. But if someone says something a little unusual and maybe it's their bullet point and they want to move on from it, she's like,
circle back
in that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she is not letting it go. So watching her interview, it sort of gave me the idea to start often just saying people, I'm not doing it the way that she does, and I'm not interviewing people for live things usually. But to just say, tell me more sometimes. Like, that's an incredibly generative prompt to say, tell me more.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that. Sukas on YouTube says, 30 or so years ago, George Carlin made a joke about the, quote, illusion of choice, 50 different deodorants, but only two political parties. He says that. And Roxanne says, because I know what I want when I shop, I like having options. Options are wonderful. They help me decide which product is best suited for me. I love that. And so I want to sort of like make the argument that, you know what, we need to start constraining ourselves a little bit more, because you had stories in your book, and we only have a few minutes left in the show, but like, you know, people have had unlimited money, unlimited time, unlimited, you know, opportunities and brilliant minds all around them, and still failed miserably. And I want you to sort of lay out why having all of that, all of those things, don't necessarily equate to creative and innovative solutions.
Yeah, I think in many cases, because it makes it really hard to figure out what not to do. So one of the important stories in Inside the Box is about this company called General Magic that was the first ever so-called concept IPO in history, where they went public with an idea because they saw the future of technology. They were basically making the iPhone a generation early, before the web even existed. And they were so visionary. It was two of the designers of the original Mac. And that talent poured in and resources poured in, so they could do anything. They had unlimited money. They had unlimited talent in making these personal communicators. And since they could do anything, they did do anything. Every time someone had a good idea, they did it. Like, the emblematic interview was with this engineer named Steve Perlman, who was supposed to write a calendar function, right? And he writes it to go from 1904 to 2096, checks it in, thinks he's done. Then a team leader comes to him and says, Steve, someone might write a historical app. You have to make this thing go back farther. So he writes it to go from year one to the future. Then another team comes to him and says, Steve, why are you tying it into an arbitrary religious context? You should start with the beginning of astronomical time. So that's how he ends up writing a calendar function going from the Big Bang into the future. And it takes months, when it would have been four lines of code if he left it at 1904 to 2096, but because they could do anything, they did. And the project just grew and grew and grew and grew until it completely collapsed under its own weight.
And so the argument is constraints actually make us focus and get stuff done.
And it's more important than ever because it has never been easier to do too much. And I've seen this with companies I've been visiting with where the introduction of AI means they are now skipping the hard work of deciding what they should not be doing, which is why it's leading to what researchers are now calling work slop, this incredible volume of like meaty stuff that nobody's really sure what they should do with.
Wow. Well, so no general magic, specific magic. That's what we want moving forward. We are time constrained here. We're at the end of our hour, which I guess makes Studio 2 better. David Epstein, journalist and author of the New York Times bestseller Inside the Box, How Constraints Make Us Better. David, this was a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and thank you to everybody who called in. Judith on YouTube, I gotta say this. She says, I'm thinking about some poor soul in an underdeveloped country listening to this and what they would think about Americans whining about having too much. Okay, Judith. Yeah, some people might think about that. Gotta say thank you, though, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm going to just decide I'm Cherry Gray.
That's what you decided?
I decided.
Nice.
Decisions made.
You were waffling for a second. You were going to say I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron, okay? We'll talk to you tomorrow.